Good evening, everyone. This is Appalling the Luscious. I'm Jocelyn, and this is Mel, and today we're going to be talking about race, gender, and relationships. Starting off with race, we have a little snippet from the Twilight Wiki. This is about the...
A very credible source.
Yeah, very credible. but this is about the, I guess, the effect that vampire venom has on people's skin. So, the Wiki weeds... The wiki reads, sorry about that, when the venom spreads, it also leaches the pigment in the skin. So after the transformation is complete, the vampire loses nearly all its skin color, as well as any moles, freckles, scars, tattoos, or any other part of the skin pigment from their human life. So, my first thought after reading that was, A, does this make people white, regardless of how dark their skin is, and B, are all vampires in the Twilight universe albinos? Because if so, I feel like they would not be able to blend in as well as they do in the movies or in the books.
Yeah, because if it says nearly all of its skin color, wouldn't they be not even white, but... translucent, which, I mean, I guess with the sparkliness, they kind of are in the sun.
Yeah, because, I mean, the wiki doesn't go that much into detail about the specifics.
And also, really, who knows where they get this information, but it also is very an interesting theory.
It really is, and the fact that a lot of, and also, like, on the wiki, it talked about how vampires' skin and just bodies are related to marble and marble statues, and how their skin cells and whatnot refract light, so it's almost like they're made of some kind of stone or whatnot.
Yeah.
But just getting rid of the pigment in their skin, because in a lot of time, in a lot of other vampire things, their paleness is explained by the fact that they don't have any blood, yeah. Which is, I feel like, a reasonable thing and
yeah,
could have gone with it. Yeah,
because the flushness of the cheeks is something that Edward loves about Bella.
Yeah.
And that's caused from blood. Mm-hmm. Blood flow.
And also, like, for James, for example, especially in the movie, you see it after they recently feed, they're kind of flush from the blood that they have.
Yeah.
So, I don't know how I feel about this. I don't know where they necessarily got the information to put on this wiki.
Yeah.
I mean, it may be from some kind of, like, Twilight Field guide or whatnot, but
I
don't know how I feel about that.
There's an interesting quote that, in one of the times that Bella is watching Edward, and she describes him as a perfect statue, carved in some unknown stone, smooth like marble, glittering like crystal. And that's just, like you talked about, marble as in, I picture, you know, the marble statues that are perfectly, you know, molded bodies and, like, part of history, but, like, beautiful and pure and, I mean, unbreakable, essentially. But, yeah, definitely this, there's definitely a lot to talk about with whiteness, I think, and vampires and what that role in the book plays.
Yeah, and especially because, like, just from this wiki, it doesn't really give an extent as to which point the venom stops getting rid of pigment. So, I mean, that can only lead me to think about the most extreme scenario where it gets rid of all of their pigment. So, like...
translucent.
Or in that sense, vampirism could be synonymous with skin bleaching.
Yeah.
Or it could be synonymous with turning people white via assimilation, etc., etc.
Yeah.
So just kind of the becoming white aspect of that extreme interpretation of what the wiki says. Which, I mean, I don't think is too far of a reach considering how much whiteness is talked about in Twilight.
Yes.
I mean, even with Bella, the fact that she's so pale is, I guess, a big part of the conversation or her thoughts, yeah.
Especially, she's pale, and she is from Arizona is the common joke. It's one of the first things that Jessica in the movie says to her when she says, oh, you're from Arizona? Aren't you supposed to be, like, tan or something? and just this, what's interesting with that part is in Arizona, her paleness made her stand out.
Mm-hmm.
And she did not, you know, look like she belonged there. But she stood out, but she also blended in so yeah. much. She didn't have very many friends. But then transport her to where...
Forks,
that's it.
Forks, Washington.
And she, especially with the vampires, fits in so strongly. But she stands out. Even though she does, like... Even though they're all pale, for some reason, her looking more like them is just making her
stand out more. Or at least in her eyes. She tends to overthink the way people look at her.
Yes.
Which, I mean, relatable.
Definitely.
But, and it's interesting because in the book, all of the vampires that the reader is introduced to are white. Or their race isn't disclosed, which leads us to assume that they were white.
Yes.
And off of that, they are described as being extremely beautiful. So you could make the connection that whiteness equals beauty because their skin is unnaturally pale. They're like marble. They have this supernatural beauty.
Yeah, it's a beauty that you can't take your eyes off of.
Yeah, and part of their beauty, I think, comes from the paleness and like the marble-like aspect of their skin.
Yeah.
Which... If you think about somebody looking like marble, you'd probably think they aren't human. Like, I can't even imagine a person. So yeah, maybe they were makeup and that's just not part of the book.
A little blush.
A little blush, something.
But yeah, going along with that, in the book, distinction that every character will, except for the werewolves.
But that's
the next topic. But in the book, every character that is either a vampire or, like, a friend or whatever is white. And then in the movie, though, we get Laurent.
Yeah, and all of her friends at Forks. I think Mike and Jessica are the only two people that are white.
Yeah.
Along with Bella.
So they tried to make a more racially diverse movie.
Yeah.
Because they probably realized that most of the characters in the book are white, and that's not necessarily something you want to put out for a movie.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of other movies do it, but that's besides the point.
True.
But no, yeah, it's interesting, given the character descriptions in the book, that they decided to make a more racially diverse cast. And I think nowadays you see that a lot more, people taking liberties with casting. To make things more diverse and, I guess, realistic.
But with the casting, we see one very positive, and that's that in the casting of Jacob's tribe, they actually used Native Americans. Let's give a little clap for that one. Kind of sad that we have to applaud that, but it is something to point out, I think.
Yeah, and I think at the time the movie was made, that was... kind of progress, and I think nowadays it's becoming more common as people are more aware of race politics and all that stuff, you know. But yeah, that kind of brings us to the whole werewolf versus vampires in relation to race. Very obvious, there's the whole colonial history, you know, the white people, aka the vampires, versus the indigenous people, aka who are also the werewolves, and just how when the vampires show up, the indigenous people have to change and react to them in order to live with the colonizers and kind of to keep themselves alive.
Yeah, for sure, because there was a problem at the start when they first came, and Jacob explains this to Bella about the cold ones who came and initially killed some of their werewolves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this brings in a lot of, like you talked about, colonial and post-colonial theory, which we can't really call it post-colonial theory because America will never be in a state of post-colonial colonialism, but just looking at the idea of the treaty that had to be made so vampires are not allowed to enter into their specific land, and cross over, all of the stuff that had to go through, and how werewolves had a threat of essentially, and mm-hmm. somebody that was able to kill them so easily, such as vampires.
Yeah, and it's like the werewolves were kind of part of their culture before they showed up, but it was the vampires showing up that kind of triggered the whole ability. At least that was my understanding when it was explained in the book.
Yeah.
Maybe. But also, going off of the whole, like, racialized other thing, Bella sees the werewolves and Jacob and his father as, because I guess in the first book she doesn't really know about werewolves. But yeah, she sees them as being in the wrong for not liking the Cullens and trusting them. So I think, I don't know, just the fact that she...
There's a lot of tension.
Yeah, there's a lot of tension, and you could kind of read that, I guess, as racialized tension, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, the vampires, the Cullens are super white, and she's kind of supporting their whiteness.
Taking their side.
Yeah, taking their side in this argument that has, definitely has colonial past history.
Yeah.
Our colonial implications, and just, I don't know, her kind of being racially insensitive.
Yeah, like, picking a side and being mad at the other side for not just going along with everything.
Yeah, and she's kind of just blinded by, I want to say blinded by the light, but blinded by the Cullens and, like, their beauty and their marble-like whiteness. And that kind of prevents her from thinking critically about...
the deep history, I think. And that's something also about the werewolves, is they're so... I mean, Edward and Carlisle kind of dive into history, but, you know, the werewolves are definitely a passing of traditions, you know, understanding history, and Jacob knows the history of his tribe before he even knows the werewolves. You know, the existence of, and the fact that he himself is a werewolf, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And with that, we have a word from our sponsor, John Proctor's V-Nex, endorsed by Daniel Day-Lewis himself.
Not really.
Visit jpnex.com and use the code Crucible, that's C-R-U-C-I-B-L-E, for 40% off your order of $45 or more. Nobody makes a deeper V than JP. That has been a word from our sponsor. And now back into today's episode. We are going to be moving into the section on gender and relationships. Starting with something that Justin and I both noticed a lot of is Bella's caretaker role in many senses of the word. But we're going to start with her relationship with Charlie.
Yes. So, there are quite a bit of passages in the book that center around her feeding her father, or providing the food for her father. I mean, just like cooking and whatnot. And she is constantly making comments about how he can't do anything in the kitchen for himself, even though he protests, saying he survived for however many years without her just fine. She takes it upon herself to kind of become his stereotypical wife figure or mother figure. Mm-hmm. I just think that's really weird. And she makes a big deal about it, because there are a couple of points in the book where she freaks out because she doesn't have dinner ready.
Yeah, no, I think about the times where she... There's especially one scene where she falls asleep thinking about Edward or something, and then she hears Charlie's car, and it's just described in way too much detail, and this is why it's standing up, but she, like, jumps out of bed, and Charlie walks in, and she's just like, oh no, Charlie, I'm sorry, I didn't get the food done, and it just this idea that, yeah, she takes it upon herself to be the main caretaker, and almost every conversation that Charlie has with Bella revolves around a meal that she has cooked for him, or meal prep, or, I mean, there is stuff about her, him talking to her about her relationship with Edward and stuff, but it's almost solely their relationship, Charlie's and Bella's relationship, is based on her doing, like, things for him.
Yeah, and another example that just came to mind was she's about to leave for Seattle, maybe, and she's like, oh, I'll get you some sandwich stuff, and I'll leave it right on the top shelf so you know where it is, and you can have that for dinner, and just... She makes it a part of her daily routine, and she acts like he's a toddler.
Yeah.
I'm like, he can open the fridge and see food in there. He's a grown man.
But also, I also think Charlie should have stopped her and been like, yo, I can do this alone. But he never does. He just lets it happen.
Yeah.
Fully benefiting from this.
Definitely, definitely. Like, he makes comments saying I can take care of myself, like I said earlier, but he doesn't really do anything to like make her stop.
Well, and I think in the movie it's interesting because in the movie she doesn't cook for him. They eat at that diner
a lot
every day, and he eats steak and potatoes or whatever, and Bella comments on it. If you would eat something other than steak and potatoes, like
steak and cobbler,
he might want to eat a salad. I think she comments on the fact that he should eat a salad every once in a while or something.
Wow.
And I was like, wow,
rude.
That is. And yeah, then moving on, we have a little bit of interesting gender dynamics with Rosalie.
Mm-hmm.
Rosalie is one of the Cullens. She's partnered up with Emmett.
Yeah, I think her name's technically Rosalie Hale.
Oh,
is she a Hale? Maybe.
No, it's just, isn't it just Jasper and Alice?
I don't know.
Who knows?
Who knows?
But
they're all related, anyways. Kind of.
So, like we've talked about in the previous episode, or the second episode, what episode are we on?
Four.
Okay, in the second episode, each vampire is given a specific power,
mm-hmm.
and Rosalie's power is, to what we understand, extreme beauty.
Yeah, so I guess it's not really a power. I think it's more just an aspect of her previous past life, physical personality or whatnot.
Yeah, and she has an immense struggle with Bella.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to go into that a little bit?
Yeah, well, first I want to say there's a lot, or throughout the book, Bella is constantly commenting on how beautiful Rosalie is and how she can't imagine Rosalie wanting anything else in life because she's so beautiful, and she almost verges on envious of Rosalie.
Yeah, there's a quote where Bella says, I was still staring at the Cullens while he spoke. Suddenly, Rosalie, his blonde and breathtaking sister, turned to look at me. No, not to look, to glare with dark, cold eyes. And then, yeah, just the breathtaking beauty.
Yeah, and like, why is she glaring at her with dark, cold eyes? Well, Rosalie's dislike of Bella seems to stem from her beliefs about what she thinks Bella should want, namely the ability to have children, which comes up later in the series as Bella gets more ingrained, I guess, in the Cullen family. She's kind of resenting Bella for her complete and utter disregard for her, I guess, human abilities and her feminine abilities, I guess.
Yeah, there's an interesting aspect of choice when in the conversation of Bella and Rosalie, and this kind of hops in with Edward too, but the idea that Rosalie cannot fathom the fact that Bella wants to be a vampire, wants to be this, and wants to take away the child, like the childbearing aspects that was robbed from Rosalie because of her brutal backstory, which comes out in Eclipse, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And just this, not only like dislike. It's like a hatred. Like, Rosalie wants nothing to do with Bella. And actually, in the end of the book, during, like, the hunt with James or whatever, Rosalie is, like, forced to... Does Rosalie get forced to put on her clothes, or do they end up making Esme do it? Because Rosalie is so against it.
Esme ends up doing it, yeah.
Yeah, but there's just this... The whole family kind of accepts Bella in, but Rosalie cannot do it yet because she cannot get over this fact that Bella chooses to be... would like to be a vampire more than she would like to be a human.
Yeah. And kind of going with... Rosalie's position, Carlisle makes Rosalie, or turns her into a vampire, because his intention is to have her partner with Edward, but that obviously doesn't happen.
Doesn't work out.
I forget why. Did they ever mention?
I think that they just didn't really groove together.
Okay.
Because then she finds Emmett.
Who's being mauled by a bear.
Literally. A dream. No, I'm kidding. but I think this dynamic between Rosalie and Bella, I've been having a hard time articulating it, but what I think it comes down to is, like, middle school drama. Like, there's, like, some... And obviously, the topics are not middle school topics.
Definitely.
But it's this, like, girl-hate-girl kind of whack drama mm-hmm. that creates tension in the family and gets... glares start happening and all of this that just it's just very
catty.
Yeah, but also I don't know if I want to reduce it to catty again because it's like
yeah
there you know but I agree
and it seems kind of one-sided because in a way Bella kind of idolizes Rosalie.
Yes.
And she doesn't like that Rosalie thinks bad of her, mm-hmm. but she doesn't necessarily think bad of Rosalie.
Yeah, she just hates... She hates that Rosalie hates her.
Yeah.
But doesn't hate Rosalie. And another female in the book is Esme.
I love Esme. She's so sweet.
She really is. And kind of going along with the blank was made for blank, we have a lot of men who need a partner. And that's
apparently.
Wow. So, okay. We have Carlisle. Carlisle met Edward. Edward was the first. And obviously Carlisle and Edward unfortunately didn't get together. Because oh my gosh, that would be amazing.
Would it? I don't know.
So Esme gets made and made as in gets turned into a vampire. Third of the Cullen clan. And Esme becomes Carlisle's wife. And she, her power, quote-unquote, is just this caring. She just cares so much and this motherly instinct. And I think about in Twilight, the movie, do they do this in the book where they're making Italian food? I know it's in the movie.
Yeah, I don't think it's in the book.
In the movie, and then Rosalie gets so mad she drops the bowl because... but they're literally making Italian food for... Bella.
Because her name's Bella, so she must be Italian.
But, yeah, Esme's power is this caring, motherly nature, because, like we've talked about, the powers are drawn from something that you most likely had in your human life.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of, like we talked about in the religion episode, tying in this Adam and Eve-esque vibe, the fact that in Genesis 2:18, right after the quote that starts the book, God sees that Adam needed a companion, so he made Eve. And I can't help but think that, like, everybody in this book, all the vampires in this book are, like, paired up, and they're in these lifetime relationships.
Eternity. And, eternal relationships.
And the kind of, like, you know, Garden of Eden pre... original sin-esque, you know, they can live on forever, hopping around from place to place, being with the person that they were literally created to be with.
Mm-hmm.
That comes into play with Esme, I think. Esme and Rosalie with Edward until that doesn't work out, and then she goes yeah. to be with Emmett.
No, yeah, and also it kind of gives, it's interesting because it gives Carlisle a kind of god complex, in the sense that he is the creator, the patriarch, which, I mean, I guess he is.
That's deep, man. All right, so moving on to one of the male characters, we have Emmett, whose power is literally just raw strength.
Yeah.
You see him just this absolute bulk, strong, can just, I love Emmett.
Yeah.
And especially in Breaking Dawn Part 1, you know, when they arm, or Part 2, when they arm wrestle because Bella's a newborn and she's so strong.
Yeah.
And they break the rock. It's so, ugh, it's so intense.
But yeah, and it's interesting looking at these female qualities and then looking at Emmett, where theirs is more empathy, feminine characteristic,
motherly,
and Emmett is just strong.
Yeah.
Like, it's the physical versus, I don't know, intuitive? That's not,
yeah,
the right word.
Well, and I think it's interesting because Esme and Emmett literally embody, like, the trope that's, like, the high school football player with the beautiful, like, I'm not gonna say...
You mean Emmett and Rosalie?
Oh, yeah. Emmett and Rosalie. I'm not gonna say Rosalie's, like, a cheerleader or whatever, but just, like, the extreme, the two popular kids, you know, the strongest jock with the most beautiful, I'm making hand motions as I discuss to show what I'm saying, but...
As you can all see.
Yes, as you can all see. And just this idea of, like, Emmett's power exemplifies maleness, mm-hmm. kind of, and, like, what men, quote-unquote, want to be. Like, you know, like, as stereotypical, you, like, guys have to be strong and tough, and that's what Emmett is. He's strong and tough and has a sense of humor. Like, those mm-hmm. are, like, the three things that society, like, forces upon men.
Yeah.
And he, like, exemplifies that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And then, this isn't necessarily brought up in Twilight. It's brought up more so in Breaking Dawn. But it's Bella's power of being a shield. And like I said, it's mainly in Breaking Dawn, but it is present throughout the series, because Edward can't read her mind because of the shield. And I think that kind of ties in with the caretaker role, of the mother, kind of protecting the people she cares about. And that's kind of, in Breaking Dawn, how she's able to access that. She's able to expand her shield to protect the people she loves. Or they use harming her loved ones as an incentive for her to, I don't know, figure out how to use her shield,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, she even learns how to cast her shield onto other people
mm-hmm.
through harming Edward. Her training is yeah. literally Edward getting shocked and Bella having to learn how to cast the shield onto Edward.
Yeah, and just the whole aspect of a shield. I mean, when you think of, like, a sword and a shield.
Oh, Pokemon Sword and Shield. Sorry.
But if you think of a sword and a shield, the shield is kind of more passive, I guess, even though you can, like, hit people with a shield.
Yeah.
But it's kind of, you think of Captain America, and that's, like, but still, like, it's not as active as a sword, which, you know, is stabby
pierces
and, like,
through.
Yeah. I don't know. It's, But, also, kind of gender fact, is female vampires cannot reproduce, which is part of the reason, Rosalie's hung up on Bella and whatnot, but men can, and that's not revealed until Breaking Dawn,
yeah.
But I just think it's weird that they're both technically undead, and it's only the women who can't reproduce. I don't know. Seems kind of sexist, but...
Yeah, and I don't necessarily want to go down this whole route of how does it actually work.
Yeah.
But that is so interesting, just the idea that men still hold the power to create life.
Yes.
And women don't.
Mm-hmm. And also that you add on the fact that children and infant vampires are illegal,
yes.
according to the Volturi, and it's a crime punishable by death. And the fact that men can have children, albeit it has to be with a human woman, but women are denied the opportunity to create children as well. So they have to be satisfied with having a quote-unquote child who's an adult, you know?
Moving on with a different relationship, we have Edward and Bella, which we've talked a little bit about, but this monogamy that is so present throughout the book with, like we've talked about a little bit, each of the vampire couples being paired up. There's also this idea of imprinting.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So with the werewolves, which comes in later, and the idea that you imprint on somebody, and that, like, is it? That's the final say. And it has actually broken up relationships with Sam and Leah.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, Sam and Leah. And Jacob imprinting on Renesmee, which is a whole different story don't really need to talk about right now. But this monogamy that is so present and really pushed in Twilight, and especially with Edward, they talk about, Alice talks about worrying, or it was Alice, Esme, or Carlisle, is one of those three.
They all kind of worry about
Edward. They all worry about Edward and the fact that he'll be alone forever, because you spent the past 100 years kind of sulking. I think it's a good way to describe
it. Sad and alone.
But there is this, like, expectation and hope that they were going to find somebody for Edward, and that's why they embrace Bella so quickly, especially that's why Alice embraces Bella so quickly, is because they've never seen Edward
so happy. Kind of.
But we also definitely picked up on the expectation to be in an implied heterosexual relationship, with sexuality other than heterosexuality not being discussed.
Yeah, not really.
Once. Even though Alice and all the female vampires were definitely a part of my sexual awakening, I would say. I think that definitely the expectation around and hopefulness around finding a mate for Edward was so prevalent, and that's why this story blossomed, was because he finally found somebody. And I think that their relationship progresses so quickly, not necessarily in a sexual sense, but like in a, I'm attached to you. Mm-hmm. It's on page 195 or 95. I mean, for sure the first half of the book where Bella, it's even on the back of the quote where she says about three things I was absolutely positive. First, Edward was a vampire. Second, there was a part of him and I didn't know how dominant that part might be that thirsted for my blood. And third, I was unconditionally and irrevocably in love with him. And I think that just this certainty that she has, that both of them, that they have so quickly. And I think this plays into the fact that Edward has been waiting for so long for a partner, that he's just so certain. The second he smells her, he's like, all right, let's get the wedding ring.
I gotta not kill you first, though.
Yeah.
But, and then also, it, like, preaches the whole, like, there's the one. There's always somebody out there for you that is kind of prominent in...
Kind of a joke on soulmates.
Yeah, it's, like, really prominent in, romance novels in general, you know? There's always somebody for you. And you don't need to have a long relationship, spending time to get to know them, because as soon as you see them, you know. Or I guess in this case, as soon as you smell them, you know.
Appallingly luscious.
Anyways, while Edward and Bella's relationship seems to be, I guess, a case of soulmates or them being made for each other, their relationship is pretty abusive. And it's not...
Very.
Yeah. Yeah. Very abusive. And it's not just necessarily Edward being abusive towards Bella. She's pretty abusive in herself. At one point she threatens to put herself in danger. She says, if I had to, I suppose I could purposely put myself in danger to keep him close.
And because Edward is constantly telling her to be safe. And he's constantly, quote-unquote, saving her.
Oh, yeah. And I think this... I think this quote operates in a conversation where he's talking about leaving her, and she's like, oh, I don't want you to leave me, so I'm going to put myself in danger because then I know you'll show up. Mm. And that's just like, yikes, because you see that when people talk about threatening to kill themselves, mm-hmm. if somebody breaks up with them. So I think this is kind of functioning in the same way. Yeah. And she's also, Bella has a lot of violent impulses and violent thoughts, hitting people, screaming at people, but she never really actually acts on them. And I think that kind of goes with the whole gendered aspect of women being passive or repressing these violent impulses as well.
Yeah.
But Edward,
let's take a list down his abusive qualities, maybe. Just four that we have right off the bat. Stalking, controlling, gaslighting, victim blaming. Anything else? We could go on probably for a while.
Yeah. So in regards to the stalking, he openly admits to watching her sleep without his consent, breaking into her house essentially to watch her sleep.
That is just, you know that feeling when you wake up in you're asleep and all of a sudden you're like, there's somebody in the room. Usually it's one of my cats that lives in the house with me, but imagine if some high school guy that you're freaking talking to, you realize that, oh, there was somebody watching me in my sleep.
All and those times I thought I imagined him, he was actually there.
And there's this scene in the movie where she, like, wakes up and makes eye contact with him and then blinks and then he's gone. And you're just like, whew, this is heavy. This is breaking and entering stalker tendencies.
And not only is he stalking her and watching her sleep, he follows her to Seattle.
Yeah.
He hangs outside her house. And once, I guess, she's aware of what he is and the fact that he follows her around, could it be considered stalking? Because she's kind of okay with it.
Well, it's kind of consensual once it gets put out there.
Yeah, but
because she does want him there when she's sleeping and stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely. As far as him being controlling, like, when, I don't even know where to start.
Well, there's the whole idea that I brought up that Edward continuously, like the quote from Appalling the Luscious, he continuously blames Bella for things that, like, she can't necessarily control, that are, like, he's like, this is your fault that James wants you so badly. It's because you smell so good.
I guess that would kind of fall more under victim blaming.
Oh, true.
But I guess, oh, yeah. I guess for controlling, he physically moves her around a lot against her will. He's picking her up, running her places.
And she does not. In the book, she gets so sick.
Yeah, she does not like that. From that running. Yeah, super fast running. She can't take it.
In the movie, they don't show that, though.
Yeah, and especially, he's super controlling when the whole James thing is going down. He picks her up, straps her into the seat.
Literally, violently. She comments on how violent it feels.
And, yeah, and he is constantly trying to tell her, okay, this is how we need to do things. He assumes that authority over her and doesn't necessarily respect her ideas or how she wants to go with things, because she wants to go back to tell her father that she's leaving.
Yeah.
But Edward's like, no.
Well, and she actually comes up with a really good plan, and I think it's Emmett has to be like, no, Edward, listen to this.
Yeah.
And then Edward finally is like, okay, fine.
gaslighting. Main point for that one is when the whole incident in the beginning with the van almost crushing her and him pushing the van away, and him basically telling her that
she's crazy.
Yeah, that she's crazy. Nobody will believe you. Kind of like, well, yeah, you know.
Well, and I think that there's a point where he was, like, surprised that she didn't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the next day they talk, and he's like, did you really not tell anyone?
Yeah.
And she's like, of course not. I just want to know the truth.
She's like, why do you even want to know the truth? Doesn't even matter. But it does. And then, yeah, like you said, victim blaming her, him blaming her for the way she smells, which kind of segues into rape culture. He says that it's her fault that James is coming after her because she smells so appallingly luscious.
Mm-hmm.
He also, I think this is at some point in further down the James hunting her story, that
mm-hmm.
He tells her that if she lets anything happen to her, happen to herself, that he's going to hold her personally accountable.
And he says, "Do you understand that?" Which is, I think, one of the most patronizing questions. You, like, explain something that is a fairly easy concept, even though it's so controlling and demanding, and then it's like, "And do you understand?" Like, it just so...
It seems like he was her father talking down to her. It's weird.
Yes.
And yeah, that just kind of goes into the role, like, safety plays. He's always telling her to be safe. She's always thinking, oh, I have to keep myself safe for Edward's sake. Or I have to keep myself safe because if I don't, then Edward's going to have to go out of his way to save me. And it's just the constant damsel in distress storyline that's just always there.
And that's all we have time for today on Appallingly Luscious. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. And don't forget, stay thirsty.